So how is everyone feeling this morning? Everyone okay?
Yes, okay, very good. Right. So for this morning, we're going to continue with what we did from yesterday, except that today we're going to look more closely at some of the actual texts that we've been talking about so far. And we're going to just start with just a sort of more or less sort of scattered survey of a few bits and pieces of suttas which we found interesting and relevant for one reason or another. And we're going to introduce some of the techniques and ideas of text critical study to looking at the suttas. Then in the next few days, over the next week, during the evening classes, we'll look a bit more systematically at the teachings on Sila Samadhi Panya, some of the main teachings in the Buddha's discourses. So for this morning, we're going to start by looking at just a brief few suttas under the headings of the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. If you remember yesterday, I mentioned that there's no connected biography of the Buddha in the early texts, and that kind of makes sense. When you think about these things, you have to look at them in the context of what was actually going on, right? I mean, you don't write a biography about your best friend, right? You only write a biography for people who don't know them, yeah? So it was only after the Buddha died and in subsequent generations they lost contact with the Buddha. They didn't know who he was. What kind of person was this? What was his life like? And so that's when they found the need to start writing these biographies. So within the suttas, in the early texts, we find lots of biographical information, but no connected biography. I mean, in one sense, you can consider the whole of the early Buddhist texts as being a biography of the Buddha, in one sense, right? I mean, every text is an event from the life of the Buddha and the people around him. And in one sense, it's all part of that story of the Buddha, his awakening, his teaching, and his passing away. But there are a few suttas that discuss some of the events of the Buddha's life in somewhat more detail, and we'll have a look at some of those this morning. Very briefly, we're just going to skim over a few things for this morning. So we just want to try and to sort of convey some kind of flavour about what was going on. So the first sutta we're going to look at is Majjhima Nikaya number 26, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. And here we find a lot of the motifs which we are used to in Buddhism. I just have to find the... pulled it up earlier. Where are we? Ah, here we go. I just noticed on the course guideline, which hopefully you all had copies of, I gave references on how to find these suttas online, but I just realized that since we did the first course, we've actually put many of these suttas, probably most of them are now available on Sutta Central, and they weren't then. So actually most of these suttas we can find on Sutta Central in the English translation. So the Noble Search. I'll just start reading through the sutta. I won't read the whole sutta, but we'll just begin, and we'll just make a few comments on it as we go, and we'll look at some of the salient points here. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove in Atapindika's park. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe went to Savatthi for alms. Then a number of bhikkhus went to the Venerable Ananda and said to him, "Friend Ananda, it is long since we heard a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. It would be good if we could get to hear such a talk, Venerable Ananda, Friend Ananda." Then let the Venerable Ones go to the Brahman Ramaka's hermitage. Perhaps you will get to hear a talk on the Dhamma from the Blessed One's own lips. "Yes, friend," they replied. Okay, so here we got a number of kind of interesting things. The Buddha hasn't been giving Dhamma talks. I wonder why that is. Maybe he was just in a bad mood. No? Don't think that's likely? No? Sorry, maybe he's on retreat? Yeah? Could be. Could be. Yeah, there were certainly times when the Buddha said he went away on retreat. Maybe he just didn't feel like giving Dhamma talks. You know, sometimes people say, oh, we need more teachings. Oh, it's so hard to find hear good Dhamma and so on. Well, it was the same in the Buddha's day. They were going, oh, come on, where's the Buddha? We want to hear some Dhamma. So quite interesting. It could have been on retreat. It might have been just travelling, I guess, and maybe had just sort of come back to Sarvati from somewhere else. I don't know. So, you know, a lot of these things, it gives us a snippet of some historical background, but perhaps in the commentaries and so on, then they might give more details. And also notice, but Ananda's response is also a little curious there, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, you'd think if they wanted to hear a talk from the Buddha, they'd just sort of go to the Buddha. I mean, this is Ananda, right? It's not as if he would have had a hard time, you know, going to see the Buddha and say, you know, can we have a Dhamma talk? So why is it that he's sort of getting people going this kind of roundabout way to hear a Dhamma talk? I'm not quite sure. Anyway, so the Buddha, after he came back from alms, said, Ananda, let us go to the palace of Megara's mother for the day's abiding. Then they went there, and then in the evening, the Buddha said, let us go to the eastern bathing place to bathe. And then he went with Ananda to the eastern bathing place to bathe. When he was finished, he came up out of the water and stood in one robe, drying his limbs. Then the Venerable Ananda said to the Buddha, Venerable Sir, the Brahman Ramaka's hermitage is nearby. That hermitage is agreeable and delightful. Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One went there out of compassion. So Ananda's kind of trying to trick the Buddha into going to this hermitage. Right? It's a bit sneaky, isn't it? So these are all the kind of interesting, you know, curious little details which you find sometimes in the suttas, which... To me, these things, you know, when you read things that have they're a bit open-ended, you know, to me that's things which have a ring of authenticity to them, right? It sounds like, you know, this sounds like something that might actually happen, and we don't necessarily understand the reasons why, right? But it sounds like quite a realistic scenario to me. And then the Buddha went up to the hermitage, because we're sitting in the hermitage discussing the Dhamma. The Blessed One went up to the door, waiting for their discussion to end. When he knew that it was over, he coughed and knocked, and the bhikkhus opened the door for him. So again, that's pretty remarkable, isn't it? Right? So the Buddha wouldn't go into the room while the monks were talking about Dhamma. He waited outside. Imagine how mortified you'd be when you finished and you found out that the Buddha had been waiting outside. Right? All the monks would be like, oh my God, you know, I was going on and on and on. Right? So, you know, interesting his kind of level of respect for the Dhamma there, yeah? So he doesn't want to interrupt, you know, just quietly waits. Okay, so then he then says, when you gather bhikkhus, you should do either of two things, hold discussion on the Dhamma or maintain noble silence. Okay, so elsewhere in the suttas it says noble silence is the second jhana. Okay. Right, so then he gives a talk on the two kinds of search. And again, this is a little bit, the segue is a little bit mysterious. But it says, they said that our discussion on the Dhamma was interrupted was about the Blessed One himself. They were talking about the Buddha and his life. So this is the kind of introduction, and so the Buddha continues by talking about his life. But when he talks about his life, he doesn't talk about, you know, he's not interested really in talking about himself, but he talks about the motivations, the things that drove him, and he talks about it especially in a way that's going to be relevant for everybody else. So he talks about two kinds of search, and here the Buddha is pointing to, or he's expressing and describing in one way, what is that fundamental motivation that led to him going forth and led to him ultimately attaining enlightenment. There are these two kinds of search, the noble search and the ignoble search. So what is the ignoble search? Here somebody being himself subject to birth seeks what is also subject to birth. Being himself subject to aging, he seeks what is also subject to aging. Being himself subject to sickness, he seeks what is also subject to sickness. Being himself subject to death, he seeks what is also subject to death. Being subject to sorrow, he seeks what's subject to sorrow. Being subject to defilement, he seeks what's also subject to defilement. This word subject here I don't like. I don't like subject. It's a bad word. The word is actually dhamma, right? So when you say that someone's subject to something, it implies that there's something external which sort of puts somebody underneath them, right? That's what subject means, but this is not what dhamma means in this context. It means that it's the nature of someone to be old and to die and so on. So I prefer to translate dhamma here as nature or something like that. Yeah. So what else has the nature of birth, or has that quality of birth? Wife and children, birth, men and women, slaves, goats and sheep, fowl and pigs, elephants, cattle, horses, mares, gold and silver. Okay, these acquisitions are subject to birth, and one who's tied to them, these attachments, infatuated and utterly committed to them, being himself subject to birth, seeks what is also subject to birth. And the same, similar with aging and sickness and death and so on. I won't go in too much into all of these details. And so what's the noble search? Being subject to birth, aging, death, seeks what is not subject to those things, and that is the unborn supreme security from bondage, nirvana. And being subject to defilement, seeks what is, having understood the danger in what is has the nature of defilement, he seeks the undefiled supreme security from bondage, nirvana. This is the noble search. So here the Buddha is describing, he's enunciating that we have a choice in life, right? And in the mythology of the Buddha, that choice is expressed in terms that the Buddha had this choice between being the wheel-turning emperor and the Buddha, right? So he can seek all of those worldly things. He can get as much worldly things as possible. Yeah? Everything you could want. Or you could seek the deathless. You could seek nirvana. And so when he's putting out this claim, or this teaching, he's not just describing what he did, but he's also issuing a challenge to the monks who are present there, but I think also to all of us. To ask what is the value of our lives? What are those things we hold to be of greatest value, of greatest meaning? Are we going to remain trapped and limited by birth, aging and death? Or are we going to seek what is beyond all those things? So we have to understand, this is the thing which drove the Buddha's a quest for awakening. And this is the point that he goes on to make in the next passage. Because before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too, being myself subject to birth, sought what was subject to birth, aging, death, and so on. Then I considered, why, being myself subject to birth, aging, death, do I seek what's also subject to them? Why do I not seek the unborn supreme security from bondage, nirvana? Why don't I seek the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, nirvana? So this usage of the word bodhisattva here is very typical of the early texts. So the word bodhisattva typically means, refers basically to Siddhartha Gautama in his quest for enlightenment. It's not used when the Buddha talks about his past lives. He doesn't use the word bodhisattva. And so the sense of the word here in the suttas is someone who's seeking enlightenment. And that search is this realization which he came to in his life. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessing of youth in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness. So here we have a description of the going forth, which of course is much simpler than the descriptions that we're used to in the tradition, and in some details seems to contradict it, doesn't it, right? Because in the tradition it tells us that he snuck out of the palace in the middle of the night, right? Whereas here it's telling him that his mum and dad are crying, and he's like, I don't care about you, mum and dad, I'm going anyway. And they're like, no, he says, I'm out of here, whatever. Like, oh, come back. So, you know, this passage, right? This passage is an incredibly pregnant one and has spurred so much creativity. The response to this passage has spurred so much creativity in the Buddhist tradition. How do we reconcile, right, that the Buddha's compassion, right, his wisdom, his kindness, right, with the fact that he just walked out on his family? Yeah? And this is one of the great tensions in this story. It would be a mistake, I think, to try to explain this away. And some people say, oh yes, but you know, his family, they could look after themselves and they were wealthy and things like that. That's missing the point, right? This is not what it says here. It's not saying, oh yes, well I knew that they were okay, so I left and I knew they'd be alright, right? What it says is that they were traumatized and they were weeping, right? That's the point that it's trying to convey, yeah? So why is it making a point of conveying this, yeah? That's the drama of it, right? This is a story, and any story has to have conflict, it has to have drama, right? Otherwise it doesn't mean anything. Right? If you just said, you know, oh yeah, I wanted to be happy and then I was happy and it was like, oh, that was all good and everyone was nice. Well, boring story, right? There has to be tension. Right? You have to feel something. I don't know if anyone has had the chance to see the film of the Buddha's life that was made recently, the Siddhartha film made in Sri Lanka. Have you had the chance to see that? Okay, yeah. It's available on DVD, yeah. Are they having a showing in Singapore? Okay, good. So, I saw... Oh, okay, they showed in Sri Lanka Temple. Oh, okay. Yeah, so one of the features of that film, I saw it in the director's home and also in Sydney, but that one of the things they really focused on was this emotional, yeah, pull, right? That was they left aside all of the magical and things, and they focused on what is the actual feelings of the people when Siddhartha's leaving home, and I think that was a really good choice by the director to do that. Each time this story is told in the traditions, it's told slightly differently. Right? And this is when you see that, you know, what you see is that the traditions are creatively responding to this, right? They're creatively responding to this tension and expressing it and describing it in all different kinds of ways, yeah? But what that tension ultimately comes down to is that conflict in values, which we saw in the previous passage, right? What are we searching for? Are we searching for what's subject to birth, aging, death, sickness, defilement? Or are we searching for Nibbana? Right? And so, at a certain point, there has to be a shift in values. There's a questioning in values, and then there's a shift. And that shift is always painful. Right? And I know, you know, that's still very, very true today. Many people have told me, you know, especially in, you know, Singapore and Malaysia, you know, they would love to become a monk or a nun, but you know, their mum would kill herself, or she would die, or they, you know, how could they do that? Yeah, and so it's very, very real. You know, it's not just an old-fashioned thing. So all the mums, don't worry about it. Okay, if your sons or your daughters want to ordain, okay, seriously. Anybody here who's in that situation, if your son or your daughter wants to ordain and you're traumatized by it and so on, then come and see me afterwards. My mum is in Singapore this week, okay? And we're having coffee and you can come and meet her and chat with her and ask her, what is it like to have a monk for a son, okay? And then you can get the inside information, okay? And I'm sure she will tell you that it's not as bad as you might have thought, okay? So, I don't know how much to sort of go into this, but there's a very famous anthropologist called Levi Strauss who had these theories about storytelling and mythology. And he noticed this characteristic that when stories are told in different cultures, what they often do is that they will present black and white alternatives, right? But then each time the story is told, it will present those alternatives slightly differently, right? And so what this is pointing to is the fact that, well, sometimes there are irreconcilable values that we have in the world, right? There are things that pull us in different directions, and we could never finally solve this. There's no answer to this problem, okay? Except, of course, if you get enlightened, then you don't have a problem, right? So in the world, that tension will always be there. And so whenever the story is told, it's always resolved slightly differently, right? So there's all these multiple different tellings of the stories which creates a kind of pattern. For example, in the Buddhist tradition, if you look in the Jatakas, this same event is told time and time and time again in the Jatakas, yeah? And the Bodhisattva, in his past lives, went forth. And how did they actually do that? What actually happened at that moment? Well, sometimes he would go off with his wife, and they would both go into the forest and become rishis. Sometimes they went with the whole palace, right? In one of the Jatakas, the whole city went forth, and they went off into the forest and made a huge forest monastery there with thousands of people, yeah? And so each time it's a little bit different, right? Sometimes they take the kids with them, yeah? There's another Jataka story, which is a very interesting one. And one of the nuns pointed this out to me one time. And the at that time the Bodhisattva was married to Yashodhara, and they had three children. And they were sitting around the dinner table one night, and he said to his wife, "Darling," he said, "you know, I love you very much." And she said, "Yes, I know, darling." He said, "but I really want to become a monk." And she said, "Oh, well, that's funny, darling, that you mentioned that, because I really want to become a nun." And they said, "Oh, well," he said, "well, I guess we have to wait till the kids grow up and we can do that." So then a bit later on in the evening, she said, "just excuse me for a minute, darling, I have to get some water from the well." So she went out to the well and didn't come back. She went off to become a nun, right? Left him with the kids, right? Right? So years later, the kids kind of, he sort of looked after the kids till they grew up, and then he went forth as a monk. Then years later, he happened to run into her again. He said, "well, you left me." So you see this kind of story, that there's what it says in the canon is one version of it, but each time is kind of different, right? One thing that's interesting, I'm going to just mention this in passing, but it's a bit provocative and it might be a bit disturbing, but there's no mention of compassion here, nor is there in any of the accounts of the Buddha's going forth. He never said, "I'm going to go forth and strive because of compassion." Compassion only came later when he was enlightened and then thought, "what am I going to do?" So it's kind of interesting. But what I'd like to look at now, briefly, I'll just pop over from the Majjhima Nikaya number 26 and have another. This is another version of the Buddha's going forth. And this is a much less well-known one. In fact, this sutta is almost completely obscure and hardly anybody seems to have noticed this. And yet it contains what may well be the earliest and the most authentic account of the Buddha's going forth. It's called the Attadanda Sutta, and it's in the Sutta Nipata, and it's in the chapter of the Sutta Nipata called the Attakavagga. And the Attakavagga is universally regarded among scholars as being perhaps the oldest collection of Buddhist scriptures, and on multiple grounds it is linguistically, the verse styles, all kinds of things, it's regarded as being very old and very authentic. And so here's a translation of the opening verses of the Attadanda Sutta. Fear is born from arming oneself. Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the sense of urgency that made me tremble. Seeing creatures flopping around like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. This world completely lacks essence. It trembles in all directions. I longed to find a place unscathed, but I could not see it. Seeing people locked in conflict, I became disenchanted, but then I discerned here a thorn hard to see, lodged in the heart. It's only when pierced by this thorn that one runs in all directions. So if that thorn is taken out, one does not run and settles down. Right. So this is giving another take on it. It doesn't necessarily kind of contradict the other versions, but it's giving another perspective, and one which I think is a very interesting one. He's talking not so much about his own sort of existential situation, but more about social conflict, right? And he's looking out at the world and looking at conflict in the world. I guess, you know, the Buddha was from a Kshatriya family, so I guess he was, you know, born into that warrior class, so there would have been people that he knew doing that. I mean, the great story in India, of course, is Mahabharata, which is about that, the warrior caste, and about, you know, fighting their relatives and so on. But how vivid and immediate the imagery is here, right? You know, like fish flopping around in too little water. Yeah? What an amazing image that is for looking around the world. And they're still fighting each other, you know? It's like we're in this world where, you know, we have this kind of precious planet, this precious life, you know? And we have so little of it, you know, we just have a few years to live and to do all the things we do, and what do we choose to do with our time, right? Go and fight each other, or, you know, it's just crazy, yeah? And so he's looking around, where can I find a place unscathed, right? So you try to look around the world and think, oh, I want to find a place where everything's perfect, and you think, oh, I know, I'll go to Australia. And then you realize, no, it's not perfect. Nothing is perfect in the world. There's nowhere you can go where everything is going to be okay. Everything in the world, it lacks essence. It trembles everywhere. Right? So this is this kind of description of what today we would call an existential crisis. Yeah? It's this kind of complete loss of meaning. Right? A complete alienation. He feels like there's nowhere he belongs in the world. Yeah? And he's looking for some solution. So, you know, when this happens, and the Buddha said, when you go through this kind of crisis, he said, well, there are two things can happen. One is that you despair, and then the other is that you have a search, right? You look for an answer. Yeah? So this is where he was spurred on and was looking for an answer. So this is, to me, this is something that shows that we shouldn't... We shouldn't shy away from this kind of thing. You know, we will all go through this in our lives, in our spiritual journey. We'll all go through a crisis of meaning, right? What am I doing here? What am I doing in this job? Why? You get up in the morning and you look around and what is this life that I have? Why did I go to school for years and get all those degrees? Now I'm doing a job that has nothing to do with all those degrees. What's going on? Yeah? And there was a song in the 80s by Talking Heads. I don't know if you remember it. What was the name of the song? And he goes, there's a line, he says, you know, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. Yeah? And you just get up in the morning and you think, what is this? Where do I belong? Who am I? What am I doing here? Yeah. So this is a real crisis, yeah, and this is something which can really kind of tip you over the edge, and if you're not prepared to deal with it, you're not prepared to cope with it, then it can end up becoming very dysfunctional, right? and you look at, you know, the stories of the Bodhisattva when he sort of went out from the palace and sort of saw the four signs, and he went back, and he was basically suffering from depression at the time, right? And he got back and he can't do anything, right? And so if you have the chance and the space to be able to go through this, it's great. If you're having to function while this is going on, then that's a lot of suffering, right? Yeah, if you've got to keep your job and pay your mortgage and be nice to people while this crisis of meaning is happening, yeah, that's a real struggle. Yeah, that's a real struggle. So I think it's okay, you know, it's important to acknowledge these points in the story of the Buddha and to learn to recognize when these things happen, you know, and then sometimes, and it's okay, when this happens, you leave your job, right? Or you take a year off or something like that. And that's kind of okay. You know, when people say to me, oh, I quit my job because I thought it was pointless, I say, congratulations. And they say, I don't know, I've got no idea what I'm doing. I say, good. Yeah? When you're going through this kind of thing, don't be in a hurry to get through it. Okay? This is not something we necessarily talk about in Buddhism all that time, because in Buddhism we're supposed to be happy all the time, right? There's something wrong with you if you're not happy. It's your fault. But the reality is we're not happy all the time. Yeah, and sometimes we're sad and we don't know why. And we look in our lives and you think, you know, my mum and dad were nice to me. I've got a nice home. I've got a good job. I've got friends. Right? I've got all of these things. I should be happy. But how come I'm not happy? Yeah. And this is when we start to go to that deeper level, right? That existential level. And that's where you have that, again, that idea of that crisis of meaning or of value. And people around you will look at you and they'll say, what's wrong? You know? You must have some deep, dark secret, you know? Do you have cancer? Or do you, you know, have you really lost, you're losing your job? Or did your boyfriend just break up with you? Or something like that. And sometimes it's just none of those things, and you don't have a reason, right? And so you just remember, it's okay, yeah? And if you can, if you're lucky enough, you give yourself the time to just spend some time with yourself and just let yourself go through that, yeah? And trust that process. While it's going on, you won't have any idea of what the outcome is. And that's a good thing, okay? The most useful thing in that kind of situation, if you're going through that, is to remove yourself as much as possible from your ordinary life. Okay? So what's happening is that the structures of your life are dissolving. Right? All those things which you thought defined you, right? I am this person, I'm not that person. I do this job and not that job. This is what, and all of those things are now falling away. Yeah? So what's actually really useful is if you can step out and let everything go, just for a period of time, and just let everything fall away. Yeah? And wait, and then gradually things will start to come back and you'll see things in more perspective. And then that sense of meaning and value and purpose will return, right? But in a new way. Yeah? But if you don't let it, if you don't let it all fall away to start with, then it will never come back and you'll never find out what it is that you're really meant to do. So you keep on suppressing it and pushing it away and you think, oh, I'm coping, right? But this point is kind of crisis, which happens to all of us a few times in our lives, okay? It doesn't happen all the time, it happens a few times in our lives, okay? And it's not a time when you should be coping, right? You don't have to cope, right? This is when you stop coping. Coping is for day to day. This is the time where you put things aside and you say, I don't have to cope. Yeah? If you're lucky, sometimes you just have to anyway. So then that's a lot of suffering. But anyway, so it's just a few words on the kind of existential crisis that we're talking about here. Let's do some meditation for a few minutes. Returning to the Aripariyasana Sutta. Again, I'll not planning to go in detail through the whole sutta. To summarize the next section, then the Bodhisattva went and practiced with Alara Kalama, Udakarama Putta, and many interesting things we could say about that, but I'll just skip over that for now. Then he went to Uruvela, Sena Nigama, Bodhgaya, and went to practice. This is an agreeable piece of ground, a delightful grove with a clear flowing river with pleasant smooth banks, and nearby a village for alms resort. This will serve for the striving of a clansman intent on striving. Then, being myself subject to birth, aging, death, and so on, I found what is not subject to birth, aging, death, and so on, the unailing, unaging, deathless Nibbana. And I thought, this Dhamma that I've attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in attachment. It's hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality and dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations. Formations is a terrible translation here, and thankfully has been expunged from more recent ones. How can you still a formation? It doesn't make sense. The stilling of all energies or activities or something like that. The relinquishing of all acquisitions, that is the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I was to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. So, here the Buddha basically just wants to relax and take it easy, and who can blame him? So then Brahma Sahampati came and invited him to teach. He surveyed the world and decided to teach the Dhamma. Okay, then it went to Kasi to see the group of five monks and taught them the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So details which and events of the Buddha's life, which we're very familiar with from the life of the Buddha, we find in one of the earliest forms here in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. Again, it's a very, very interesting sutta on many levels, but I won't go into too much into the detail of it. Okay. There's another sutta which I'll just look at briefly, and that's the Pachetana Sutta. I mentioned a little bit earlier about the Jatakas and the Jataka collection that we know, and the Jatakas which are very popular in the Buddhist tradition, almost all of them derive from a later period. But there are very few Jataka stories which we find actually in the early suttas themselves. And even so, in those cases, most of those are ones which have various signs of being later for one reason or another. But this is one of the very few stories which we find in the early Buddhist texts, which seems to be a Jataka, perhaps one of the earliest ones. And it's also quite a nice story. So the Buddha was staying in Benares, addressed the bhikkhus, because in the past there was a king named Pachetana. Then King Pachetana addressed a chariot maker. Friend chariot maker, 6 months from now there will be a battle. Can you make me a new pair of wheels? I can, Lord, the chariot maker replied. So this just reveals something interesting about the society at the time, right? I mean, can you imagine a king going in person, right, to the carpenter and saying, can you make me a new pair of wheels for 6 months' time, right? This is not a developed society we're talking about. This is a fairly small and intimate culture. Right? And remembering that urbanization was just emerging in the time of the Buddha. Now, if this is talking about a time before that, then what they're calling a king is much more like In medieval times in Europe, you'd have like the Lord of the Manor or something like that. So, you know, it'd be somebody who has a little fiefdom or something, but not sort of a great king like King Ashoka or anything. Can you make me a new pair of wheels? So after 6 months, less than 6 days, the chariot maker had finished one wheel. King Pachetana then addressed the chariot maker. 6 days from now, there'll be a battle. Is a new pair of wheels finished? Right. So that's all the preparations he needs to make for a battle, right? That's it. He says, well, in the last 6 months, less 6 days, I finished one wheel. But can you make another one in 6 days? He says, I can. Then over the next 6 days, the chariot maker finished the second wheel. He brought the new pair of wheels to King Pachetana and said, here is the new pair of wheels that I've made for you, Lord. Well, what's the difference between one of these took 6 months less 6 days and one took just 6 days? What's the difference? I can't see any difference between them. He says, well, there is a difference. So he rolled the wheel that took 6 days to finish. It rolled as fast as the impetus carried it, and then it wobbled and fell to the ground. But the wheel that took 6 months less 6 days to finish rolled as far as the impetus carried it, and then it stood still as if fixed on an axle. And he asked, why is that? And then he said, well, the one that took 6 days to finish has a rim that's crooked, faulty, and defective, and the other one is well made. Okay, so a nice little story, right? And a nice little parable, very useful in your work. I've used this many times when talking to people and getting people doing work and things like that, and they say, oh, look, I'm trying to get this finished and so on, and I'll send them a link to this sutta, and I say, take your time, yeah? Do a good job. We're not so worried about deadlines and things like that. There are some very practical things in some of the suttas. There's another one in one of the jatakas, the Samuddhavani Jataka, which is actually one of the most interesting jatakas on all kinds of levels. But it's especially, well, one of the reasons it's interesting is because it starts out with a bunch of carpenters in the city who were loathed by everyone in the city, because whenever they used to do a good job, they'd go and they'd start doing the job and then they'd never finish it and they'd go and do another job, and they all went around taking all these contracts and never finishing them. And if you've ever worked with tradesmen in Australia, you'll be very familiar with those kinds of techniques. And so... So this kind of shows you how these things are not new. Anyway, so yeah, nice little story about that, and about, you know, doing something quality and so on. But it also very interesting, because then it says it may be because you think on that occasion the chariot maker was someone else, but you should not think in such a way. In that occasion, I myself was the chariot maker. Right? I was skilled in the crookedness, faults, and defects in wood, but now I'm the Arahant, I'm the Buddha. I'm skilled in the crookedness, faults, and defects of the body, speech, and mind. And then says a bhikkhu who hasn't abandoned those defects in the body, speech, and mind has fallen down in this Dhamma and Vinaya like that wheel. And therefore you should train yourself. We will abandon these crookedness, faults, and defects of the mind. So I find this very interesting as a jataka, for a number of reasons. For one thing, like all of the jatakas and so on that we find in the early texts, the Buddha doesn't call himself a bodhisatta in the previous life, and there's no hint that he was sort of already trying to get enlightened. Okay? There's nothing about trying to get enlightened here. In fact, in other stories, he actually explicitly says that the practices and things he did in that life did not lead to enlightenment. But here, even more interesting in this particular one is that he's not the king, right? He's the chariot maker. And in the suttas and the Vinaya, the chariot maker is regularly mentioned as one of the low and mean and despised ways of livelihood, okay? So he's not, a great lord, a great king, or anything like that. He's somebody who's a humble craftsman. He's doing one of the least respected jobs in the kingdom, yeah? So again, quite interesting that perspective. So this is why I think of all the jatakas that we find in the early texts. Again, there's not that many of them, but of the few that there are, this is always the one that strikes me as being the most realistic. So, yeah. Yeah, well, that's another one that has a number of very interesting and quite... So the question was whether the story of Gatikara, the potter... in which case Jyotipala was the bodhisattva, and that always strikes, you know, as another one which seems very interesting, because his behaviour there is quite unexpected for what you'd think of a bodhisattva, like he doesn't want to go and see the Buddha and things like that. So yeah, that also strikes me as being quite authentic. Yeah. So you know, I think what we're seeing here is the kernels of that Jataka tradition. Yeah. So yeah. All right. Okay. Back to So having had a brief look at the early suttas, the presentation of the Buddha and so on, let's have a look at the Dhamma and some of the characteristics of the Dhamma. And we're going to have a quick look at the Apanaka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 60. And this is a nice sutta because along with, you know, it's quite typical of the early suttas, especially a number of suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, which give us a means of knowing, an epistemology, right? How do we find out the truth? Okay? And all too often, I think, in religions, too invested in saying, this is the truth, this is the truth. And it seems to me that the more that people insist this is the truth, that the more they're covering up their own doubts and their own insecurities. And so in Buddhism, we shouldn't be going around sort of insisting Buddhism is the truth and all this. You know, one of the signs of somebody who's ignorant in the suttas is somebody who insists, idameva satchang mogamanyang, yeah? Only this is true, everything else is silly, okay? So from a Buddhist point of view, we always have that attitude of investigation and inquiry. There's a lovely passage in the suttas sometimes you have when the monks went to listen to teachings from different hermitages and different ascetics and places, and they heard things and they didn't really know what to make of it. And it has this phrase there that uses not accepting and not rejecting it, we will go and inquire about the meaning of what was said. Yeah? And that is a beautiful expression of that Buddhist attitude. Yeah? So when we hear things, we're neither overly gullible, right? Nor are we overly critical. We're not just rejecting things out of hand because, oh, this is not real, this is not the Buddha's, and so on. But we want to inquire as to the meaning. That's how you learn, okay? That's how you grow in wisdom. Yeah? So the Apanaka Sutta is one of those suttas which is teaching us how to do that. One method, one set of ways how to do that. So just some details on the Apanaka Sutta here. So if we go to sort of central, we can look here at the details of the sutta, and this will tell us our parallels. So here we have the Apanaka Sutta has a number of Sanskrit fragments, parallels, and no Chinese or Tibetan parallels, curiously enough, which is somewhat unusual. Here we have an image like the ones we saw yesterday, and this is giving us a fragment of the Apanaka Sutta in Sanskrit. So, yeah. So the actual text of the sutta is... Where are we now? Here we go. Okay, so let's have a look at the sutta. Incontrovertible teaching. That's what I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was wandering in the Kosalan country together with a large sangha of bhikkhus, arrived at a Kosalan Brahmin village named Sala. The Brahmin householders of Sala heard the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from a Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the Kosalan country. Now a good report of that master Gotama has been spread to this effect. That Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of worlds. This, of course, is the Itipiso chant, and this was a summary of the Buddha's qualities. He declares this world with its gods, its maras and brahmas and so on. He teaches the Dhamma, which is good in the beginning, middle and the end. Now it is good to see such arahants. So Even though these were Brahmins, then they obviously had heard a good reputation of the Buddha and were interested to go and learn from him. In the early Buddhist texts, there is a complex relationship between the Buddha and the various Brahmins. And they neither, you know, some of them wanted to hear what he said, some of them criticized him and so on. And we see something of that complexity here in this setting. The Brahmin householders of Sala went to the Blessed One, some paid homage to him and sat down at one side, some exchanged greetings with him, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, sat down at one side, some extended their hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and sat down at one side, some pronounced their name and clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side, and some kept silent and sat down at one side. Okay? So they all have different reactions and responses. Yeah? This is a very realistic depiction of the Brahmanical culture at the time, and it's one which is very much in tune with the Brahmanical scriptures, which are more or less contemporary. It's the Upanishads. And in the Upanishads, you see a very strong questioning within the Brahmanical tradition at the time. And you indeed, it might seem very weird. You might think, hang on, the Brahmins in India thought that they were the best. They thought they were the repositories of all the sacred knowledge and so on. Why would they go and see a Kshatriya to ask him for questions? Because they were so insistent on class, right? You might think that's a very unrealistic detail. It was pointed out by Thomas Rhys-Davids many years ago. We actually find in the Upanishads, the Brahmanical scriptures, exactly that same thing happens, that the Brahmins go and receive. In fact, many of their core teachings in the Upanishads are revealed to Brahmins by Kshatriyas. Okay? So this idea that they would be going to see the Buddha and asking him questions and so on is actually very realistic within that tradition. And so what was happening was that the old truths of that religion were breaking down. Okay, the Vedic religion, which the Brahmins had inherited, belonged to a different time and place. It belonged to a much simpler time and place. Ultimately, it was inherited from the nomadic times of the Indo-European peoples wandering into India and so on, and it was settled in the Kuru Kuru country a few hundred years before the Buddha, and it was relevant for that time and place, but it was losing its relevance in the time and place of the Buddha. Society is changing, new technologies, new social situations, new questions, and the old certainties were no longer satisfying. Yeah? So in the Buddha's time, through the whole of society, there's this kind of spirit of questioning. And this is, again, one of those qualities of the early suttas, which when I came across it, I found I could have that real kind of connection with, because it felt very much like my own time. And I felt like I'd come from a background where I'd been brought up in a religion which taught me a lot of supposed truths and certainties, which I couldn't accept were truths and certainties anymore. And we were living through a time when all of our values, our technologies, our society, everything is changing very fast, and we need to find a new way to give value and to give meaning to things. And so these things which I find in the early suttas really resonated, I think, with what's going on with us in our modern time. And one of the interesting things, you know, you notice here is that what's effectively happening is an interfaith dialogue, right? That's what they're doing. And a large percentage of the suttas are, in fact, interfaith dialogues. Yeah? The Buddha did not live in a Buddhist country. Yeah? And this is, I think, one of the big problems that we have in modern Buddhism, that most Buddhism happens in Buddhist countries. And you know what happens? It gets boring, and it gets complacent, and you get lazy, and you take things for granted, and you think, oh, you know, this is our country. This should be a Buddhist country. And you conflate Buddhism with nationalism, and you forget about the Dhamma, and it loses all of its kind of spark and its vitality. I think Buddhism is much healthier to be in a plural society, much healthier to be with other religions where you can, you know, talk to other people of different beliefs, where you can learn more about your own beliefs in that way, where you can disagree with people, and when you can learn very unexpected things. Yeah? So this is one of the things that I always do in Australia a lot, is different interfaith dialogues, and I've learned a tremendous amount from doing that. Every time that I do it, I learn a lot from the other people doing the different religious traditions. And many times, you know, you learn unexpected things. Right? I remember one time I did this interfaith event at a school in the west of Sydney, and we're talking to all these, you know, teenagers. And one of the teenagers said, one of the questions that they asked was, what happens to us when we die? Right? And so there's like me, there's an imam, there's a Christian, Anglican pastor, a Jewish rabbi, was there a Hindu at that one? I can't remember. And probably a Catholic priest or something like that. And we went down the line, right? And everyone gave their answer, what happens when you die, right? And every single person on that panel said, I don't know what happens when we die. Yeah? But this is what our religion teaches. Yeah? And that, you know, that's the kind of thing that you realize. Oh, actually, you know, so many people say our religions are dogmatic and these kinds of things. But that's not what I was seeing. What I was seeing was people who admit, actually, I really don't know, you know. But their teachings are giving them a framework that lets them kind of make sense of it, lets them approach it, maybe gives them some hope. Right? And so these are the kinds of things which are interesting. Actually, when I go to do interfaith, you know, I often learn a lot, especially about what I personally find in Australia is that on the kind of social side, that often the Christian religions and so on are much more sophisticated and much more together than we are in Buddhism. They're much more advanced, right? But the thing which is always lacking is the contemplative side, you know? And they just don't know, you know? I gave this meditation in a church service once, and the priest came up to me afterwards and said, you know, that's the most peaceful that this church has ever been. And so often when I do the interfaith dialogues, right, everyone gets a chance to speak, right? And everyone's got so many things to say. And by the time it gets to me, very often what I do is I just say to people, do you think we'd maybe do some meditation for the next 10 minutes? And everyone goes, yes, that'd be great. So we just do some meditation, yeah? And people come up to me afterwards and say, you know, that was the best part of the whole day, yeah? Yeah? And so often, you know, from Buddha's point of view, rather than trying to compete with others and say, we have to do the same things they're doing, we can learn from them, right? But we also don't forget what is there that's uniquely valuable about our own tradition, right? It's not copying other people's traditions, but it's saying, what actually have we in our tradition, right, which is going to enrich what all they're doing, right? That's actually useful, not just for us, it's useful for them as well. And they can see, hang on, there's something really valuable about that, yeah? About that ability to just be silent and be peaceful for a while. Anyway, okay. So it's a bit of a spiel on interfaith. Okay. So here the Buddha then goes on to talk about... interfaith dialogue, and the Buddha says... Householders, is there any teacher agreeable to you in whom you have acquired faith supported by reasons? No, venerable sir, there is no teacher agreeable to us in whom we've acquired faith supported by reasons. Since you've done this, since this is the case, I'll teach you the incontrovertible teaching. Okay, so again, very, very interesting situation. Faith supported by reasons, right? And the Pali here is, I did prepare this earlier, but I can't remember which tab it's on, so... or maybe I've closed that tab. Look like I might have closed it. Okay, so I can do this. The phrase faith supported by reasons, you find here is akaravati sadha. Okay? Very important phrase, yeah? Akaravati sadha, yeah? Reasoned faith, faith supported by reasons. One of the... I talked yesterday about modernist Buddhism, and about how one of the characteristics of modernist Buddhism was that it was rational. Yeah? And so we're always looking for a rational basis of things. And this was one of the key points made by people like Thomas Rhys Davids and others, that he pointed to the Pali texts and said they're rational, right? They make sense. They're not superstitious and magical and mystical and all of these kinds of things. And the people, the reformers in the Buddhist traditions recognized that this was the case, and they recognized that there was a need to reform the Buddhist traditions. Eh? Now these days, I think a bit unfortunately, the kind of fashions in academia have kind of changed, and it's become fashionable to criticize this this point of view of Rhys Davids, and by saying that this was like this idea of Protestant Buddhism is like, well, actually they were just reading their own presuppositions into the Buddha's texts, right? They were rational modern people, and they wanted to see the suttas as being rational and modern, so therefore they read it into the text, right? This is a theme which you found in academic Buddhism in the last few decades. But the problem with that critique is that, well, the suttas really are rational, and it's not, you're not just making stuff up, okay? There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of suttas which actually are perfectly rational, and where the Buddha gives these kinds of teachings. You're not just reading things into the suttas, you're reading things out of them, right? And so this, when we read about this phrase, akaravati sadha, this is something which is should resonate with all of us. Very often, if, you know, and these things are actually meaningful and useful in our modern society, right? If you've ever had a debate or discussion with somebody these days about science and religion and things like that, right? What will they say? Oh, science is rational and religion is just faith, right? Oh, you just believe these things on faith and so on. And in Western discourse, it's very important to understand that this conflict between faith and reason, right, is a product of Western philosophy and Western discourse. It does not belong in Buddhist discourse and in Eastern discourse generally, but especially in Buddhist discourse, okay? It's a function of the schism between faith and reason, between science and religion, between that came about in Western civilization for a variety of historical and social reasons, okay? And that schism has never been a characteristic of Buddhism. So don't succumb to the temptation, right, of allowing those Western problems to be imported into Buddhism, right? Don't buy into that debate, okay? We have to understand that from a Buddhist point of view, reason and faith are not opposing each other. Right? They are supporting each other. Real faith is akaravati sadha, it's reasoned faith. And this is not something that's opposing science. In one of the things you find in the suttas, it gives lists of different kinds of mental problems and their antidotes, right? And whenever we see that, we see that these are always make sense. They're very straightforward and rational. So, for example, if your problem is agitation, then the solution is to still your mind, right? If your problem is anger, then it will say your solution is to develop loving kindness and so on. So this is a very rational psychology. But the interesting thing is that when it says your problem is doubt, okay? If your problem is doubt, what's the solution to doubt? Well, what you would expect is to say the solution is faith, right? But what it says is the solution is inquiry. Yeah? The antidote to doubt is inquiry. Yeah? And this is very, very important. Yeah? So when we're Buddhism, we have doubts. Don't just try to squash it. Don't just try to push it away. Don't just say just have faith. You ask questions. You find out the answer. I had a friend who was a monk, an English monk, and before this he had studied theology in England, and he said that the joke in the he had been a Christian monk and studied theology. He said that the house joke in the theology department was that studying theology was the quickest way to make you lose your faith. Right. So sometimes this is what we're kind of afraid of. We think that if we ask too many questions and, you know, dig under the surface, that we're going to somehow lose our faith, right? But remember that what we want, if we lose our blind faith, our andha sadha, right, good, right? Good. Get rid of your blind faith. It doesn't serve anyone any good. It's just ignorance, yeah? What we want is our akaravati sadha, yeah? So don't worry about whether you lose your faith or not. Worry about what is the quality of your faith. And a little bit of akaravati sadha is worth a big ton of andha sadha. Okay, so moving along. Okay, so the Buddha then says, what's this incontrovertible teaching, aparinaka? So this is a version of what's known in Western philosophy as something which, the name of which will occur to me soon. Pascal's Wager. Is that right? Pascal's Wager? I think it's Pascal's Wager. Is that right? Yes, I'm getting a couple of nods from the audience. Pascal's Wager, which, what's Pascal's Wager? I'll see if I can probably Google it, probably a bit more safer. Pascal's Wager. Okay, so Wikipedia is our friend. Okay, Pascal's Wager, an argument in apologetic philosophy that was devised by the 17th century philosopher Pascal. It posits that all humans bet with their lives whether God exists or not, right? Given the possibility that God actually does exist, and assuming an infinite gain or loss associated with belief or unbelief in said God, right? So then a rational person should live as though God exists and seek to believe in God, right? So if God does not actually exist, then such a person will have only a finite loss. Okay, so you understand the argument here? If God exists, right, and I believe in him, then I'm going to go to heaven forever. I get an infinite response. So no matter what I give up for that, it's got to be worth it. And even if the possibility that God exists is infinitesimally small, even if it's only a tiny, tiny fraction of 1%, right, it's still rational to believe in God because I get an infinite reward from it. Okay, so this is Blaise Pascal's argument, which, well, yeah, we can discuss that or think about that. But this is the Aparinaka Sutta is giving a similar kind of argument, but not quite to the same extent, to talking about the existence of God and so on, but using an argument about how we should live our lives. Right? One of the problems with Pascal's Wager is that belief is something you can't just decide to have because it's rational, right? So you can argue with yourself that, oh yes, I should believe in God because it's rational, but it doesn't really change your actual beliefs, right? But what the Buddha's talking about here is how you should behave, right? There are some recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine of view is this: there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good and bad actions, no this world, no other world, no mother, no father, no beings who are reborn spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins in the world who have themselves realized by direct conduct and declare this world and the other world. Okay, so this is one of the standard descriptions of wrong view in the sutta. In suttas, and it's an opposition to the idea of karma and rebirth. Okay, so when it says there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, it's not saying that nobody gives anything. It's basically saying that there's no fruit and result of good and bad karma. Same thing when it says no mother and no father. It's not denying that people have parents, but it's talking about the value of service and gratitude and love for your parents and so on. No beings who are reborn spontaneously. This like refers to devas and so on. And it's also saying not only are these things not real, but that nobody has actually seen them, so that all the people who say that they've seen these things are just deluded, right? So, for one thing, this is an important counterpoint to the view which you sometimes hear, which is that the Buddha only taught in karma and rebirth because everybody accepted it in Indian society, right? This is a view which you hear countless times. People make this argument, and it's one of the most stupid arguments I've ever heard in my life. A 12-year-old school child has the critical capacity to be able to reflect on the views that are held in society around them and to ask whether those views are true or not, right? A 12-year-old school child has the capacity to realize different people have different views, okay? And I can make up my own mind, right? And so this argument is positing the fact that the Buddha has less critical faculties than a 12-year-old school child. It's completely idiotic. The Buddha constantly was reflecting on the views of people around him, and as you find here, reflecting in the suttas, that there was a diversity. It's like a bubbling cauldron of views. I mean, the diversity of views in that society and practices was in many ways far greater than we find today, right? I mean, we might find people who have different views today, but we rarely would find a religious teacher or philosopher actually arguing that there is no such thing as good and bad, right? People might talk about it in different ways, but to say good and bad are not real and doing good and doing bad is not going to do anything for you and just so whatever, do what you like, there are not many people who do that, and you'd probably get in a bit of trouble if you tried to teach that. So there's these radical teachings, and if the Buddha wanted to teach that, he could have, right? But he didn't, not because he was somehow conditioned by a society, but because he saw the truth for himself. That's what he says. So others, recluses and Brahmins, whose doctrine is directly opposed to that, and they say there is what is given and what is offered, and so on and so forth, right? And the Buddha says, now, don't these recluses and Brahmins hold doctrines directly opposed to each other? Yes, Venerable Sir. Now, this is also another interesting point. Often we find in religious circles today that people say everything's one, okay? Oh, we're all one. And this is something, you know, I've mentioned before, I do a lot of interfaith. This is one of the things that annoys me about interfaith. And we go along and people say, we're all one because we all believe in one God. And I'm like, hello, Buddhists over here. No God. Hindus over there, they're a bit... Yes, there's one God and there's many gods and there's no God. And so, you know, this idea, which is, you know, that everyone really believes the same thing, this is an idea which is disrespectful of each religion, right? Because each religion has its own teachings, right? And it has its own qualities. And if you say all the religions are just all the same in the end, it's just meaningless, right? It's a renunciation of your critical faculties. Yeah? Actually, religions do teach different things, right? Doesn't mean that one religion is better than the other or anything like that, but it means that they have different strengths, different qualities, different weaknesses, and it means that we have a chance to learn from each other. If all religions actually just teach the same thing, why bother listening to each other? Right? Well, it's all the same. Yeah? So this is that kind of attitude, it's all the same, is not an actual description of religious teachings. It's an implicit refusal to listen to any religious teachings motivated by fear. Because if you acknowledge that there is genuine difference, then you're afraid of what that's going to mean, right? What are we going to do? We're going to blow each other up because we have different beliefs or something like that. Well, or we could like be adults and understand that people have different beliefs and it's okay, right? So, anyway, so, and here we come to the Buddha's argument. Okay, so given that this is the situation in the world, people have these different views, right? So, it's, if you believe that there's no fruit and result of good and bad action, it is to be expected that you will avoid the three wholesome states, good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and good mental conduct, and that you'll practice three bad things, bodily and verbal and mental misconduct. Why? Because you don't see any danger in what is unwholesome, okay? Now, somebody who does believe in those things, then you can expect that they will have... I was jumping ahead of the argument. Since there is actually another world, right, one who holds the view that there is no other world has wrong view. Since there actually is another world, one who intends that there is no other world has wrong intention, and the same thing with wrong speech. Okay, so this wrong view, wrong speech, opposition to noble ones, convincing another to accept an untrue Dhamma, self-praise and disparagement for others, these evil and wholesome states thus come into being with wrong view as their condition. About this, a wise man considers thus, if there is no other world, then on the dissolution of the body, this good person will have made himself safe enough. Okay? But if there is another world, then on the dissolution of the body after death, he will reappear in a state of deprivation and unhappy destination in perdition, even in hell. Okay? So this is the case of somebody who's saying that there is no other world and who acts out on behalf of that, tries to persuade others, then maybe you're going to be happy enough for this life. Okay? You can do what you like, and you, as long as you don't get put in jail or whatever, then you're fine. So, and if it truly is the case that there's no other world, then you die and you disappear and it doesn't make any difference. But if there is, then you go to hell. Okay? Now, whether or not the word of these good recluses and Brahmins is true, let me assume that there is no other world. Still, this good person is here and now censured by the wise as an immoral person, one of wrong view who holds the doctrine of nihilism. But on the other hand, if there is another world, then this good person has made an unlucky throw on both counts, since he's censured by the wise here and now, and after death he'll go to hell. He has wrongly accepted and undertaken this incontrovertible teaching in such a way that extends to only one side and excludes the wholesome alternative. Okay, so the point he's making here is that it's not just about what happens after you die, but also in this very life that you will suffer if you do bad things, because good people will criticize you and look down on you. Okay, and then the opposite applies for somebody of right view. So, again, we don't want to go too much into detail with these things. I'm giving you like a flavor of the Dhamma and a flavor of the way that the Buddha approached these things. Yeah, and so you can see that in talking with the Brahmins here, he's engaging with them, right? He's using hypothetical cases. He's saying, if this is the case, then that's true. If that's the case, that's true. He's leading them onwards and trying to persuade them, right? So he's not like using the force of his authority to sort of demand that they accept a certain truth, right? He's pointing out, systematically pointing out different aspects of a problem and drawing out implications of those aspects. Yeah? And so this is what we mean when we talk about Akaravati Saddha, is reasoned faith. Yeah? And so you can follow that argument through and then come to the conclusion. Yeah? Any questions about that before we move on?
In your view, what are the weaknesses of Buddhism?
Oh goodness! well, quite a lot. But like I mentioned before, I think a lot of traditional forms of Buddhism are very complacent, and I think that's certainly true within the Theravadan world. That we don't see a lot of vitality, a lot of energy. People tend to be very very stuck on the idea we have the real original Buddhism and we're doing the real original thing, and they just keep doing that same thing. And I don't see a lot of spark there in many cases. Yeah, it just seems to sort of drift along. So I think this is a big challenge for, especially in the Theravadan world. I think people don't appreciate enough what the value of the teachings that we have. And then there are other more specific things, specifically the role of women in Buddhism, and that's something which needs to change, and we need to get over this thing. And we see in so many religions around the world are tearing themselves to bits by arguing about silly things that are really just so obvious, right? And we shouldn't let Buddhism do the same thing, you know. And we have the advantage of having a religion where it is actually very beautiful, and where, you know, we do find teachings like this. It's very reasonable, it's very rational, and all of those things. And so we need to focus on those strengths, find faith in those strengths of Buddhism, and not be afraid of modernity, not be afraid of change, right? And not be afraid to question our institutions. Yeah. So, I mean, there are a few things which I think is issues, yeah. I mean, another thing which is more general in Buddhism is the standard of education, I think, is shocking. And, it's what I'm trying to do here is to try to, you know, give people more of a grounding in Buddhism and Buddhist scriptures and so on. But I mean, the reality is, if I think, you know, some of my friends are teachers at universities, right? And I've you go along there and so on. And like, if you're teaching Christianity at a university level, right? Every student has read the Bible, right? If you're teaching at a Buddhist school, most of the students have never even heard of the suttas, okay? Much less have actually read any of them. They haven't even heard of them. Okay, I mean, when I was in Thailand, right, so this is where this kind of really struck me. I was staying in a kuti by myself, and the kapia who was looking after me, who owned the kuti, he'd been a monk before for a number of years, and he's obviously quite dedicated, right? He's built a kuti, he's looking after the monk there, and so on. He was a monk for several years, and one time I visited another monastery nearby, and they had a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya, and I asked if I could borrow it. And when I came back, I had this book, and he said, "Oh, what's that?" And I said, "It's the Majjhima Nikaya." He's complete blank. What's that? He's never heard of the Majjhima Nikaya, right? I mean, he was a monk for years. He's never heard of the Majjhima. It's a complete blank. What is it? I've got no idea, right? Can you imagine a Christian say, you know, the Gospel of John, ever heard of it? Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Bible? I've heard of the Bible something. Yeah, isn't that this kind of book or something? I mean, it's just terrible, right? And that's not an isolated case. It's normal, yeah. Certainly in the Sangha in Thailand, you can finish your 9 years as a monk in the ecclesiastical study and exams. Right? They have a 9-year program, which is theoretically equivalent to a PhD level. And in that 9 years, they don't study the suttas once. Nothing on the suttas in 9 years of study. Yeah. And so the suttas are too holy. Yeah? So this is, to imagine that could possibly be the case in Christianity or in Islam, for that matter, is just ridiculous. I mean, they all know their teachings so well. And yet in Buddhism, for some reason, we just ignore our sacred scriptures, yeah? And that has a massive effect on all kinds of things, right? And what kinds of practices we do, how we live, how we think about Buddhism, and all of these kinds of things. So these are some of the issues, I think, which we're facing in Buddhism. Many others I could talk about. Buddhist nationalism is a big problem. Okay, any other questions?
Yep. Follow on to the question just now. I think there are a lot of sutta, and as beginners, are there any efforts to try to stage it for beginners who are to look at? If you were to look at some of the Nikaya, it's so thick, and as beginners, after they look at the thickness, I think they just flip the first few pages and just keep it at the bookshelf. So is there any effort to
make
extract part of it, and say for beginners, you start with some of these?
And well, that's what we're doing here, isn't it? Yeah? Yeah, so yes, there are many efforts, but lots of people doing that. That's what we're doing here, and lots of people have been teaching and things. So if you know, don't make excuses, right? There's lots of people been teaching. Yeah, if you go these days, there are lots of resources available. There are hundreds of talks and sutta classes on YouTube. There are lots of books that have been published and all kinds of things. Yeah, so yes, it can be a lot better, and we're working hard to make it a lot better. But if you're interested, don't make excuses to yourself, yeah? And, there's always something that you can do. Okay, I'll tell you a story. This has nothing to do with the suttas, but I'll tell you a story anyway. I read an article many years ago in a newspaper, an Australian newspaper, and it was talking, the journalist was saying that she had been shopping. She'd go to the supermarket. And when she was shopping, she saw a man shopping, right, pushing along a shopping cart who didn't have any arms. Right. He turned out he was Australia's first thalidomide child, and so he didn't have any arms, didn't have any hands. He was pushing this shopping trolley along, and he would reach up with his foot, grab things off the shelves, throw it in the shopping cart, and push the shopping cart along. She thought, wow, that's pretty, he's pretty independent and stuff. That's pretty good. Anyway, so he pushed his cart along and came to the checkout counter. Right? And then the lady at the checkout counter took the things out, put them in bags, right? He took his wallet out of his pocket, gave her his credit card, right? Paid for things, then picked up the bags, right? Think about it. Picked up the bags, hopped out of the supermarket, threw the bags into the back of his pickup, jumped behind the wheel of his pickup, lit a cigarette, and drove off. Right? And so this journalist who's watching all this is thinking, I've got to find out who this person is. Right? So she went and did some research and did an interview, and then they wrote this article about him. And he was as I said, Australia's first thalidomide child, no arms, no hands, lived on a rural property with his second wife, where he drove the tractor and looked after the property. His day job was driving a backhoe. Right? He had done, among other things, he was a recording engineer for the ABC radio in Australia, right? He was a piano player and composer, yeah, who recorded his own songs and had started his own record label, yeah? He was also a filmmaker, yeah? What are the other things that he did? He was teaching himself to ride a motorbike at that time, yeah? And one of the other things that he did, unsurprisingly, was worked as a motivational speaker. Right? And he'd go to all these companies and just ask people, what's your excuse? Yeah. And they asked him, you know, how do you do this? And he said, well, when I was a kid, my mum and dad just told me to go for it. You know, whatever I wanted to do, they just said, do it. So when he wanted to learn to ride a bike, they said, sure. They bought him a bike and he terrorized the neighborhood riding around the bicycle, the neighborhood without any hands. Yeah. So this is the thing, the opportunities are there. We have the chance to practice. So, we put in a bit of effort. Don't expect to get things without any results. Yeah. So, you know, when I was first a monk, don't think these things are easy for anyone. When I was a monk in Thailand, we didn't have the suttas in the monastery. Right? I had a few bits and pieces of things, but gradually we find things, gradually we learn. I taught myself, right? I never had a teacher to teach me suttas. I mean, we had a few classes from different people, but basically most of the things that I learnt myself. So, take an interest, yeah? Put in a bit of work, and these days we can find lots of stuff on the web, and if we want to learn, we can. All right, so... Panaka Sutta. Okay, now I'm thinking it's 20 past, so we're going to finish at 5:30, is that right? So I might just miss that one, because that one's probably a bit long. I'll just have a look at this sutta, the Nalanda Sutta, and this will be enough for this morning. And this is a teaching with Venerable Sariputta, talking to the Buddha, and I shouldn't have opened all these tabs, because I can't see... what's in them. Let's do this. Nalanda, here we go. So, from the Samyutta Nikaya, number 47. And this is the time the Blessed One was dwelling at Nalanda in Pavarika's mango grove. Venerable Sariputta approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down on one side and said to him, Venerable Sir, I have such confidence in the Blessed One that I believe that there has not been, nor ever will be, nor exists at present, another ascetic or Brahman more knowledgeable than the Blessed One with respect to enlightenment. So, of course, as we know, Venerable Sariputta was born in Nalanda, that was his hometown. So this event actually is happening close to the Buddha's death, and this is the record of the last time that the Buddha met Sariputta. The Buddha then says, lofty indeed is this bellowing utterance of yours, Sariputta. You have roared a definitive categorical lion's roar. Okay? But then he goes on to ask him, have you now, Sariputta, encompassed with your mind the minds of all the arahants, perfectly enlightened ones arisen in the past, and known that these blessed ones were of such virtue, such quality, such wisdom, or such dwellings, of such liberation? When it says dwellings here, it actually means meditation attainments. No, Bhante. Then have you also read the minds of the arahants and the Buddhas in the future? No. Then have you read my own mind? No. Then, when you don't have never read the minds of all of these people, how can you say such a thing? And Sariputta goes on, Venerable Sir, I
I don't have any direct knowledge of this by reading the minds of the Buddhas, but still I've understood this by inference from the Dhamma. Yeah, very important term here, Dhammanvaya, yeah, inference from the Dhamma. Supposed, Venerable Sir, a king had a frontier city, and here we're coming back to our favourite topic of cats here, so that's good. Suppose, Venerable Sir, a king had a frontier city with strong ramparts, walls and arches and a single gate. The gatekeeper posted there would be wise, competent and intelligent, who keeps out strangers and admits acquaintances. So again, quite a small scale city or fortress. As he's walking along the path that encircles the city, he would not see a cleft or an opening in the walls even big enough for a cat to slip through. He might think whatever large creatures enter or leave the city all enter and leave through this one gate. So too, Venerable Sir, I have understood this by inference from the Dhamma. Whatever arahants, perfectly enlightened ones, arose in the past, all of those blessed ones had first abandoned the five hindrances, corruptions of the mind and weakeners of wisdom, and then, with their minds well established in the four establishments of mindfulness, they had developed correctly the seven factors of enlightenment, and thereby they had awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. And, Venerable Sir, whatever arahants will arise in the future, and the Buddha, who is in present, the arahant, the perfect and enlightened one, did the same thing. Right? So notice this sequence of teaching that he's expressing here. Abandoning the five hindrances, developing the four satipatthanas, yeah? Then developing the seven factors of awakening, the seven sattabodhanga, and then realizing enlightenment. And this group of dhammas, abandoning the hindrances, four satipatthanas and seven bodhangas, this is a set of dhammas which we find mentioned together quite a lot in many different places. Okay, so we learn to recognize this as a characteristic group of teachings in the early suttas. And so this, he's pointing out, is the way to enlightenment. Right? So again, just to notice that in the early suttas, we don't find any distinction between the Buddha's path to enlightenment and anybody else's path to enlightenment. Okay, so there's no kind of this distinction, or there's a Buddha and there's an arahant and these things are different. It's just, this is the way to nibbana. This is the way to abandon ignorance. Yeah, and it's developing these things. Nothing to do with past lives, nothing to do with developing baramis over the years, nothing to do with all of the jatakas and all of those things. The only thing that matters, abandoning the five hindrances, developing the satipatthana, and developing the seven factors of enlightenment, and then awakening to the supreme enlightenment. And here, of course, satipatthana, as usual in the suttas, is mainly a basis for developing samadhi. Okay, so the seven factors of enlightenment are mostly emphasizing on samadhi. The establishments of mindfulness, satipatthana, is what you do in order to develop that samadhi. Good, good, Sariputta, says the Buddha. Therefore, Sariputta, you should repeat this Dhamma exposition frequently to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, male and female lay followers, right? So again, this is all these things, when you read them, it sounds like it's maybe just nothing special or whatever, but actually this is undermining so many of the preconceptions that we have, right? Frequently, you should teach the bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen, right? So this idea that somehow, oh yeah, there's a different path for lay people and monastics, right? Oh yeah, we just have to give dana and stuff, and then we'll be okay. And you know, I was at a Thai dana in Perth some time ago, and somebody was drinking or something like that, and there was one of the Thai women or something like that had some alcohol or something, and one of the Western men said, "Oh, you shouldn't drink," and then she's like, "Oh, I'm not a monk." Yeah. Oh, the monks keep the precepts for us, right? You know, so as long as they, the monks keep the precepts, we can give the dana, and then we'll be okay. Yeah. So this kind of idea, this is not what the Buddha's teaching, right? It's not whether you're bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, laymen or laywomen doesn't matter, right? The important thing, do you have hindrances in your mind? That's what matters. Can you abandon those hindrances, right? Can you develop mindfulness and satipatthana? That's what's important. Can you develop these seven bodhangas, yeah? That's what's important. Can you become awakened? So if you can do that, then you can overcome ignorance and develop and realize nibbana. Though some foolish people might have perplexity or uncertainty regarding the Tathagata, when they hear this Dhamma exposition, their perplexity or uncertainty regarding the Tathagata will be abandoned. So notice also that this is coming from what they call Dhammanvaya. It's an inference according to Dhamma. This is another very common misconception which you find in modern Buddhism. And one of the things that you frequently hear in modern Buddhism is that it's all about direct experience. Okay, you know things because you experience them directly. Right? But notice how this sutta is constructed. Sariputta says, "No, I did not have direct experience of these things." That's Sariputta talking, right? That's not just any old Joe Blow, right? Right? So Buddha's saying, I did not have direct experience of these things, but still I can speak with confidence. Why? Because I can infer. Okay? So an important part of wisdom, a crucial part of wisdom, is inference. Okay? This is very, very important. And this is a part of basic Buddhist epistemology from the earliest time right through all of the Buddhist traditions. Okay? And the Buddhist traditions developed this question of epistemology to a great deal of detail. And they all said that there are two aspects to developing a wisdom. One aspect is direct experience, which in the later epistemology they call pachaka. And the other one is inference, anumana. Okay, two things: direct experience and inference, anumana. And it's absolutely essential that we have inference. This is basic to any kind of deep insight. Okay, when you see something, okay, right? I can see that this thought is impermanent. Right? I have a thought; it passes away. It's impermanent. But how can I know that all thoughts are impermanent? I can never see all thoughts. I can only see this thought, okay? So to understand that all thoughts are impermanent, I use inference, yeah? To understand sabbe sankhara anicca, all conditions are impermanent, it's an inferential realization, right? It's not a direct experience, okay? You can't see all sankharas. So wisdom, the arising of wisdom, requires these two things, direct experience and inference. And that's find that all the way through the early suttas, all the way through the Buddhist traditions, right? Unfortunately, in modern times, that seems to have got lost. And you find a number of teachers who will kind of dismiss this idea of that inference is involved and say everything has to be direct experience. This is silly. It cannot happen. The mind simply does not work that way. Yeah? If you go to a greater detail, you can't even see that a single thought is impermanent. Okay? You cannot see in the present moment impermanence. Why? Because you can only see what is there. Right? If you have a thought in your mind, if you look at it in a lot of detail, you can never see that this thought is impermanent. Right? I said before you can see this thought is impermanent, but I was generally you kind of can, but you can't really if you think about it closely. When the thought is there, you can see that it's there. When it's gone, you can see that there's nothing there. But you can't see that that thought used to be there. That's an inference. That involves time. Impermanence involves time. Direct experience only happens in the present, right? You see what's happening in the present. So anything you say that's to do with impermanence must involve an inference because it involves time, right? So understanding impermanence is an inferential realization. You look at your experience, you keep going back to that, looking at the present, looking at the present, looking at the present, and then that inference comes to you. How that inference comes, right, is quite mysterious, right? These are things that you can't program, you can't force them. It will come to you in its own good time, right? But then this realization happens, it just arises, right? And how do you know what's the real inference, what's the real realization? You know because there's a letting go, yeah? See, if I just see that this particular thing is impermanent, right? Well, maybe there's another thing that isn't impermanent. I can see that this thing isn't suffering, so why don't I go out and find something that isn't suffering? Yeah? So this is why to understand the Dhamma and have those deep insights, we use inference to come to a generalization about things. Yeah? All sankharas are suffering. Why am I going seeking after them? Yeah? So anyway, this is just a few kind of remarks on the nature of epistemology and inference in the Buddhist scriptures. Know that, you know, inference, even here, Sariputta will infer truths about the Dhamma, things that he hasn't experienced directly for himself. Okay, so I think it's now 10:30, and I infer from that that we are going to have the direct experience of a cup of tea very shortly. Is that right?
And also to allow you the direct experience of some rest.
Okay. So what's the ten? And when we come back at
11 o'clock, you do a Dharma talk on why Buddhists must know the suttas.
Okay. Okay. And then that's for the general audience. Is that
that's
right?
That's what.
Okay. So 11 o'clock, come back. Okay.